I'm going to talk about some things that stood out about the earliest Christians. So if you look at page 11, I'm just going to kind of talk about a few of these items, and then we're going to move to page 12 and start talking about sort of the Middle Ages and sharing the gospel in that time period. There were three things that stood out about the earliest Christians, and I'm not talking about the bad reputation the Christians had. I'm not talking about the fact that they thought all these awful things about our people, about the Christians, about the church, but three things that would have stood out to anybody who was watching gospel people. The first thing is they would have noticed the transformed lives and character that the Holy Spirit had worked into those who were Christians. We saw this earlier. We saw this last week that Christians were marked in many ways by sort of an unwillingness to participate in those signs of death that were a part of the Roman society. There was an awful lot of death, destruction, personal destruction that was a normalized part of living in Rome, and Christians removed themselves, wouldn't participate in those things. So that's a detriment on the one hand, but then also on the other hand, it is one of the biggest things that make them stand out from the rest of society. The second thing was the corporate impression that was made on people by Christians. And what I mean by the corporate impression is, if you're in Roman society, one of the things you're very used to is voluntary segregation. You spend time with the people who are at your class level, right? You spend time with people who make the same money as you, who have the same work as you. There are people who are less than you. It was a given for the Romans that there were some people who were greater and there were some people who were lesser. And so you didn't associate with the people who were lesser than you, except maybe to boss them around and tell them what they were supposed to do. And yet here the Romans are, and they're very scandalized because in the church they see rich and poor worshiping alongside each other. They see masters and slaves relating to each other as equals. That's just so hard for us to, even us today, to wrap our heads around that master and slave would stand before Christ on the same level. The idea of Jews and Gentiles worshiping alongside of each other, these things were scandalous. And they made the church, in some ways, they made it very appealing. Especially if you're a poor person, you're going to be very interested in sort of the fact that Christ brings me up to the same level as my master, and the master is brought down to the same level as the person who works for him, right? That is something that absolutely makes Christianity stand out in the Roman society. And actually, if you think about it today, it actually is true today as well. Think of how self-segregated people are. People in America, let's just think about our own culture. In America, what does everybody do? They want to hang out with people who have the same politics as them. Everybody wants to hang out with somebody who has the same interests as them. One of the interesting things about church, and I guess I point this out every now and then, and maybe you've heard me say it before, is that in church, you are worshiping alongside of people that you didn't pick to worship alongside of. You rub shoulders with people that you don't run into the rest of the week. Right. Think about the people that you run into here just at Evergreen each Sunday that you don't see on Wednesdays. You don't see them on Fridays, but you do run into them here, right? It's a group of people that we're all very different. You got variety of income levels, variety of backgrounds, variety of languages. A lot of us, English is not our first language. And yet here we are, we're all worshiping alongside of each other. It's actually something that, again, stands out because we do have a society where everyone says, oh, you're supposed to be with everybody who's like you, hang out with people who are like you, who think like you, think people have the same income level as you. Just think of how self-segregated our society is. And the church still is something that stands out in that respect. It is still something that actually makes the church very different from the rest of the world. Third thing is the capacity of Christians to face criticism, hatred, persecution, and death, and they did it with joy. One of the most profound examples that I'm sure you all are very well aware of is in Acts chapter 5. It's just still so striking. You know, the apostles get arrested because they're doing public preaching. They're being told you can't preach the gospel. The text tells us that they called in the apostles, they beat them, and then charge them not to speak in the name of Jesus and let them go. just to stop right there, you know, what is our instinct today if this is something we experienced? I think we would be outraged. I think we would say, I'm getting a lawyer. And maybe that's the right thing to do, but we would say, I'm outraged. I'm getting a lawyer. I'm going on social media. I'm telling everybody how I was treated. And instead, they get thrown into the prison, and it says that they left the presence of the council, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer dishonor for the name. It is something that makes them stand out. A very justice-oriented society, right? The Romans are used to a due process when something happens to them, when they get mistreated, and here they are, and they don't have this Roman mindset. It makes them stand out. It makes them different. It makes them weird. Christians were weird. We're still weird. But they were weird, and it made them stand out. I want to mention five approaches to evangelism, or at least five aspects of evangelism in the early church. That you remember these early years. First thing is, evangelism took place on secular ground in secular places. It was the opposite of a Christian environment where they are ministering, where they're telling people about Jesus, right? Evangelism took place as a personal appeal, not an external compulsion. They couldn't make somebody come to church. They couldn't make somebody become a Christian. There was no social pressure to become a Christian. There was no political pressure to become a Christian. There was no commercial pressure to become a Christian. There was no reason to come and be a part of the church except that you wanted Christ. It's actually one of the things that I think culturally it marks a change. And it marked a change from when I went from the South to when I came up here. I would say up here, there's very little institutional, political, social, commercial pressure to come to church. If anything, it's generally the opposite, where if someone at your job were to find out that you were a Christian, they just to make your life miserable, they probably could. They probably could make it difficult. You probably could have a trip to HR ahead of you if somebody ever heard one of my sermons or something like that, right? So one of the things that I love about pastoring a church up here is that generally the people who are coming to church are not doing it because they have to. They are doing it because where else can we go? Christ has the words of life. You know, there's not an institutional reason that you're here except that you want to be, which is amazing. It's actually a really fun group to be a pastor of, people who decided to be here at all. Second thing is, evangelism was personal, and it took place in individual conversations, right? So you see in the New Testament, a lot of time people spend in homes. There's a lot of time spent in homes, sharing meals, showing hospitality. You have instructions from Jesus where he talks about showing hospitality to traveling preachers. We don't just see that in the New Testament. We see it in the Didache. The Didache is one of the earliest records of the teachings of the early church outside of the Bible. Justin Martyr's First Apology, he talks about this, how Christians would spend one-on-one time talking with people, persuading them to become a Christian. Which, remember, we saw this last week, it's not easy. It's an uphill battle. You've got a bad reputation that you've got to contend with. You've got to correct misunderstandings that people have. And that takes time, and it takes somebody who's willing to listen to you, somebody who trusts you, somebody who would hear what you have to say. The third thing is, the home provides a natural context for sharing the gospel. This is one of the things Michael Green talks about an awful lot in his book, Evangelism in the Early Church. He talks about the fact that the home ends up being the center, not just of individual conversations, but oftentimes church gatherings are in a home. Usually they're in a home or somewhere on the property of a home. There have been excavations of early Christian churches and chapels. One of the things you sometimes find is that you'll have maybe a wealthy person who has a larger property, and on that property, they will actually have sort of a chapel that they've built that people can gather in. And those spaces are not big. Those spaces have room for maybe 30 or 40 people. And so clearly what you find, and you find signs that there was worship that took place in that place. Sometimes you'll find like a fresco on the ground. I don't know if fresco is the right word, a mosaic of some sort where they'll have a fish. And that's one of the ways that they can tell this place was used for Christian worship. But it took place usually on private personal property. A fourth thing is, churches were planted very quickly in the first and second century. So essentially, it seems to have sort of revolved around evangelism and discipleship, and then they would evangelize and disciple these people to the point where they were ready to be elders in the local church. Paul goes to Ephesus. He's there for 2 years. So even there, you know, you might think, well, that's a long time. Well, no, it's not a very long time. 2 years to develop elders in a church, that's actually incredibly impressive. So that's one of the things you see, is that the early church, they're very rapid in their church planting. They're moving quickly. They're getting Jesus out there. They're making sure that there are places, sort of a home base that the churches can operate from. And then they go out into the culture. The fifth thing is that the earliest Christians place a great deal of emphasis on the work of the Spirit. The early Christians are not convinced that they are alone in persuading people to come to Christ. They didn't see themselves as ministering by their own power. They did not see themselves as alone in trying to persuade sinners to come. Instead, they were convinced very deeply believed that they were just instruments in the Redeemer's hands. That's why you see them taking risks. That's why you see them doing dangerous things. That's why you see this sort of absence of fear that you maybe would expect in such a wild culture as the Roman culture of the first and second century. So you have that groundwork that's laid by Jesus in his teaching, and then you see it expressed in Paul, and you see it in Peter. You see it in those New Testament writings, and it becomes sort of the lifeblood of the way that people evangelize. One of the things that after we talk about the history of evangelism, we're going to move to talking about the theology of evangelism, specifically the theology of conversion. And you might think this is a really out of place, you know, series to just suddenly stop what you're doing and talk about conversion and how that happens. But what I really think is going to happen is you're going to see that doctrine of conversion and see how it is that God changes the heart. And instead of making us more passive and lazy, we instead become more energized by it. That actually, the more we understand how God works in changing someone from having a heart of stone to a heart of flesh, we're going to be really enabled to go out and share the message, because now we're not as afraid, because now we've seen what God does. Normally, I'd find a good place to wrap up there and kind of end it like a sermon almost, but that was just what I was supposed to do last week, and I moved too slowly. So what I want to do now is sort of move from this era, and I have to admit, it's kind of not a very gentle, none of my transitions here are going to be gentle, because I'm trying to cover big periods of time, and you're not going to feel like we're moving easily from one to the next. Instead, we're just kind of jump, and hopefully you'll be able to piece some things together. But I want to talk about evangelism in the early Middle Ages. When I say early Middle Ages, I mean that period of like 500 to 1,000, where, let's admit it, that's probably the era of Christianity that we know the least about. You know, we talk a lot about the early church. We love the early church, but then we get past the early church into the early Middle Ages, and it just feels like foreign territory to us. And all I want to do is just give you a little bit of a sense of what evangelism looked like during this period. And part of why you need to have this in place is because when we talk about the Enlightenment, probably next week, or not next week, because next week we're going to have Holly and Evan here talking during Sunday school. But the week after, we're going to talk about I just had an idea and then I completely lost it. What's that? That's right. Yeah, we're going to talk about the Enlightenment, but to grasp what's going on in the Enlightenment, you've got to know what they had before, and you have to see what a huge difference it is, because the Enlightenment brings us closer up to the air we're breathing now, and so we've got to have a sense of these things. As far as sources for the Middle Ages, you might think, where on earth do you go to find out what evangelism is like in the Middle Ages? I had two sources that I read a lot from. One of them is Venerable Bede. Venerable Bede has a book called The Ecclesiastical History of the English People. He talks a lot about the conversion of the Anglo-Saxons. He talks about how Christians ministered to the pagans, and that's really important. The other thing is Hughes Oliphant Old has a book that you wouldn't think very much is about evangelism, but it actually is. Hughes Oliphant Old has a book called The Reading and Preaching of the Scriptures in the Worship of the Christian Church. And volume 3 is all about the medieval church. And so he just gives a really good summary, not just of the missionary work that was taking place really in Europe, but a really good idea of what preaching sounds like to pagans. So he's got sermons by Boniface that he preaches before the pagans. And it's just incredibly interesting. I'm going to draw a little bit from that, but I have to move fast, so I may not get to cover everything. In fact, you see this outline here. No way I'm going to cover all of this, but hopefully we can at least get sort of a good sense of sort of the environment of the Middle Ages, a little bit of what it looks like. This might seem a little odd. I actually want to talk about Christian toleration of pagans and sort of what starts to happen in the early church, because here's what takes place. First few hundred years of the Christian church, Christians are the minority. Christians are the weirdos. Christians are the ones that get slandered. They're the outsiders in Roman culture. And early on, during this time period, you've got someone like Tertullian, who's considered an early church father. And one of the things Tertullian does is he gives expression to sort of Christian tolerance for those who are unbelievers. He gives a good picture of kind of how we should think about toleration. So he argues this. He says that faith in Christ is persuasion of the heart. It can be argued for, but Tertullian is really insistent that you can't coerce it. You can't make somebody believe in Jesus. You can't hold a sword to someone's throat and get them to convert. You know, you could maybe get them to externally accede to what you're demanding of them, but that's not real conversion. So listen to what Tertullian says. He says, "It is only just and a privilege inherent in human nature that every person should be able to worship according to his own convictions. The religious practice of one person neither harms nor helps another. It is not part of religion to coerce religious practice, for it is by choice, not coercion, that we should be led to religion." And you can imagine in Tertullian's context, he is not writing in a context in which Christianity is the religion of the empire. What he's really arguing for is the right to practice his Christian faith in a culture where it would be tempting to suppress Christianity. And Tertullian is arguing for the freedom of conscience, for him to be able to worship, even though everyone around him is worshiping the Roman gods and worshiping the emperor. Now, here he says a little bit more. He says, "Let one man worship God and another Jupiter. Let one lift suppliant hands to the heavens, another to the altar of Fides. Let one, if you choose to take this view of it, count in prayer the clouds and another the ceiling panels. Let one consecrate his own life to his God and another that of a goat. For see that you do not give a further ground to the charge of irreligion by taking away religious liberty and forbidding free choice of deity, so that I may no longer worship according to my inclination, but am compelled to worship against it. Not even a human being would care to have unwilling homage rendered him." So that's sort of one voice that you see there in the early church. You see Tertullian sort of speaking up and saying, look, Christians should have this freedom. But he kind of sounds like a liberal Westerner in a lot of ways, doesn't he? He's basically saying, let's all have that freedom. And in all of us having that freedom, I'll be able to worship Christ and nobody will compel me one way or the other. Now, I'm going to bring in another voice here, and that's the voice of Augustine. So Augustine is somebody whose theology clearly changes and evolves over his life, so much so that you really do have to talk about early Augustine and late Augustine, and that's going to be the case here. Early on, Augustine believed this. He says this in a letter to Vincentius. He summarizes his former belief. He says he used to believe that no one can or ought to be constrained to believe. So there he's saying he used to basically have Tertullian's view. That's Augustine talking. And then later, though, Augustine has a change of mind when it comes to compelling others to believe. So he has this bitter struggle with the Donatists. And at the end of his struggle with the Donatists, he changes his tune. And instead, he starts to advocate what he calls righteous persecution. And this is, again, if you are a liberal Westerner, this is just super uncomfortable to you, I think, probably. But here's what Augustine came to believe. He came to believe that, yes, you cannot change how someone thinks, but he says the threat of force can break the heavy chains of inveterate customs. This is the language that Augustine uses. Basically, he comes to believe that the threat of coercion cannot impart truth, it can't impart faith, but it can at least prepare the heretic to hear and receive the truth. That's his mindset, right? Basically, if you put pressure on somebody, you can't make them change their mind, but maybe that pressure can become a factor in their mind change. Essentially, he says persecution can soften up a particular hard-hearted but lazy heretic. And, you know, if you know Augustine's story, you know his struggle with the Donatists, you know the theological controversies that you've been through, you could sort of see, like, I don't know, I kind of get like this picture of just kind of a grumpy older Augustine who's sick of fighting, you know, like, and maybe that's not a very good historian of me, but that's sort of how I read him a little bit. But here's the thing. You can see perhaps that this was the same attitude the Roman emperors had toward Christians. So before Christianity is the official religion of the empire, well, Augustine's singing the song they were singing, you know, putting pressure on Christians. We can't change the way they think, but we could certainly put that pressure and make that a factor in how they would turn away from Christianity and perhaps turn towards being better Roman citizens. So I'm giving that as background to you so that you can see Christians are having these debates. What happens when we come into power? Should we persecute others? Should we evangelize by force? Is there some sense in which we should use our power and flex our strength and sort of draw people in that way? Now, what I'm going to do is now talk about what ends up happening after the time of Augustine, or actually not after the time of Augustine, but around the time of Constantine, what happens? Constantine, his change is that Christianity becomes tolerated. Then Theodosius II in the late 3rd century becomes the emperor, and Christianity becomes more and more entwined with power, more and more entwined with authority. And under Theodosius II, Christianity becomes the official religion of the empire, and paganism is now on the outs. And Lord Acton summarizes this period. He says, Christianity, which in earlier times had addressed itself to the masses and relied on the principle of liberty, now made its appeal to the rulers, threw its mighty influence into the scale of authority. Yes. Now, it'd be interesting to have a conversation and talk about whether that's good or bad. Is it good for the leaders and the rulers of an empire to be Christian? You know, my gut instinct is to say yes, but you do see it sort of introduces its own changes. In some ways, I think it's not hard to argue that sense of power ends up changing how Christians think too. It ends up touching our theology. Now we are able to justify those moves that we make when it comes to our neighbor. Augustine now has to make that defense, doesn't he, of compulsion when it comes to worship, when it comes to force or the role of force. So you know it doesn't end up like you can have a politics that does one thing and then the theology ends up being untouched. Instead, I would argue that for sure Christianity ends up being changed by its contact with power. It ends up being affected by it. And you might think, well, that's for the better. You might say that it's for the worse, but I don't think you can deny that when it comes in contact with that power, that it ends up being different than it was before. Here's what ends up happening, though. Massive sweeping social changes, not least of which is that now Christianity and membership in the church becomes highly desirable. If you have an interest in advancing socially, politically, if you want to work for the government, if you want influence and power, you're going to start to gently ease your way into the church and become a part of what's happening over there. And that's an incredible change from the early days where Christianity was hated and slandered and looked down upon, and now it's suddenly this desirable thing. So the religion of the poor, the religion of the weak, the religion of the widow becomes the religion of the poor and the king alike now. Now the king is worshiping alongside of the subjects. You see this throughout the Middle Ages that a lot of churches actually would have a throne in the in the chapel or in the place where the religious service took place. And that was a place where the king could sit. There was actually a throne where the king would sit and listen to the sermons. You see this, I think it's in Scottish churches. I should stop talking off the top of my head where I've seen these before, but it certainly was a fact that people anticipated that the kings would be worshiping in the same place right alongside of the subjects. That's an interesting change that happens in society. Here's what happens. This is about evangelism now. Evangelism's essence begins to shift in a culture where most people are considered Christians, right? How do you evangelize people who already are baptized? They're already within the bounds of the church. They're already under compulsion to participate in these things. So how do you evangelize in a culture like that? This is a question that gets asked a lot in different aspects of Christianity. I mentioned the South before. The South is like that, right? When I was preaching in the South, I would preach to unbelievers and I would preach in an evangelistic way, but I almost always preached assuming that the listener believed they were already in. You're talking to someone who sees themselves as an insider to the church. So nearly anybody you run into in the South, if you say, "Hey, are you a Christian?" They'd say, "Yeah, I was baptized at First Baptist Church." And be like, "When was the last time you were there?" And they say, "Ah, 7 years ago. I'm still on the rolls," you know, because they're not removing you, you know. And that's what it was like in the South. Well, how do you evangelize in that culture? A lot of what you're doing is trying to convince people they're not saved. There's a very negative kind of, you hold out the gospel, so it is positive. But then again, the work is sort of showing somebody that, yeah, it's more than the external participation. So your evangelism ends up being sort of more of a gospel center, do you really know Christ? That sort of ministry. And so a lot of the evangelism that actually ends up taking place ends up being on the frontiers. It ends up being what we would think of as missions work, that sort of thing, which we will talk about. So let me talk about tolerance and missionary efforts. So during this period of time, what you have is you have individuals, they're still sharing Christ with their friends. They're still sharing Christ with their neighbors. They're still convincing them that, hey, you know, you should not just come to church. You should believe these things. The earnest efforts are happening on the frontiers. So Theodosius becomes the emperor. Constantine had already banned animal sacrifices. That was the first step towards banning paganism. When they ban paganism, they do it slowly. They do it in a way that makes things uncomfortable for pagans. It makes it more difficult for pagans. They don't outright suppress it. They don't outright fight it. They don't make it illegal. But instead, they just sort of ban aspects of it. They ban the animal sacrifices. Theodosius issues the Theodosian decrees in 389. That was the real ban on paganism. It forbid visits to temples. It forbid pagan holidays that were originally supposed to be work days. The pagan holidays were decreed to be work days. So you don't get the day off anymore for Saturnalia or whatever. Witchcraft becomes a punishable offense. There is something called the Altar of Victory in the Senate House. That gets torn down. And so here's what happens. Theodosius tolerates paganism in some ways, but in some ways what he does is he's really attempting to extinguish its practice, but he wants it to feel kind of natural the way that it happens. He's pretty shrewd. He's really got a sense of you don't just push people there right away. Instead, you sort of take it easy when it comes to that. So beginning in 392, pagan temples start to get removed. They start to be torn down. These things happen bit by bit, not in a rush. Some of these things are official acts. A lot of these things are just things that Theodosius chooses not to stop, right? So you have individuals throughout the empire who go through and remove these things. And, you know, Theodosius says, who am I to stop the people from removing these pagan shrines? There were temples in Gaul, Egypt, Alexandria, in Delphi, in Carthage, in Syria. We have good reason to think that either Theodosius or his grandson put an end to the Olympic Games around 393. Edward Gibbon tells has his famous book on the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. He describes the death of paganism under Theodosius. This is how he says it. He says, "The generation that arose in the world after the promulgation of the imperial laws was attracted within the pale of the Catholic Church, and so rapid, yet so gentle, was the fall of paganism that only 28 years after the death of Theodosius, the faint and minute vestiges were no longer visible to the eye of the legislator." So notice this, that for the first time, Christians begin to deal with unbelief in their midst, not through persuasion and through argument, but through social pressure and through active legal suppression. That also happens under Justinian. I didn't really factor Justinian in here, but Justinian ends up becoming an important Eastern emperor as well. But essentially, once the emperors are Christian, the shoe is now on the other foot for the first time, and really Christian leaders are coming to terms with a question. In a society where the leadership is Christian, what should our attitude towards unbelief be? Now, early on, the attitude was tolerance and persuasion. And here, I want you to be able to see that as the Middle Ages move along, the turn starts to happen, however, gradually. And the move is away from toleration, more towards coercion. So for Theodosius, the question is, what do you do when a massive percentage of your population is pagan? And his answer was, you use a series of carrots and sticks. You offer something for participating in the church, something for participating in worship, and maybe you offer reasons not to practice paganism any longer. You sort of take away the veneer, take away sort of the perceived pluses of participating in that. Generally, within the Roman Empire, the approach was not to persecute pagans. It was just to remove their shrines, remove public ceremonies, and just kind of create friction for your dedicated, average, run-of-the-mill pagan, if that makes sense. So missionary efforts. What do missionary efforts look like in the context of the empire? Well, you have the establishment of monasteries, and monasteries end up being very important to all of this. So for the next 500 years, the spread of Christianity can largely be seen as centering around the monastery. Now, it's not a model that we use today. We don't really generally build monasteries and think, okay, now our missionaries can go out from the monasteries. Usually what we do is we plant churches, and then we build up the Christians there, and then they go out into the culture. That's getting ahead of ourselves. We're going to start going to that place eventually, though. But here's what the monastery served as. It served as an outpost of Christianity from which the faith could emanate and have a steady, consistent presence in pagan territories. If the monastery is a stable place where gospel preaching happens on a daily basis, what you start to see is that there are acts of mercy that are given to the people and the culture around. The monastery ends up being a place of righteousness and goodness, a place that ends up blessing the people, and the people end up very open to a Christianity that comes from that kind of a place. It is hard to imagine the spread of Christianity throughout Europe, for example, without monasteries. Should know, though, that there is a great deal of the exact same thing happening in the East. Philip Jenkins has a book, I think it's called The Lost History of Christianity, where he talks about the spread of Christianity into the East. But the reason that's a lost history in some ways, and I'll put quotes around that. The reason it's lost is because when Islam comes through in the 700s, 600 and 700s, they steamroll the churches, they end up converting them into mosques, and a lot of Christian history is just destroyed and defaced and erased. So the legacy that we have in Europe of Christian monasteries and churches is just not there in the East the way that it is in the West. But one of the things Jenkins talks about is that there was a rich Christian presence in the East before Islam came through, swept through, and really destroyed that history. So when we talk about monasticism, let's talk about Benedict of Nursia. Benedict of Nursia lives from 480 to 543. And Gregory the Great says this about Benedict. He says, "Benedict's monasteries became like lamps shining in the darkness, drawing the lost toward the faith." That might sound like Gregory is just sort of going through and just trying to kind of talk up something that this other person is doing. But I actually think instead it's better to think of it as this is genuinely how these monasteries functioned. You need something stable that you can work from. You need somewhere stable that you can sort of be sending people out into the countryside from. Somewhere you can go to and you know you'll have food to eat, you'll have a place to rest, you'll have a place where you can hear good preaching, and then you go back and you do it all again. You got to recharge and then you go back out into the world. So these monasteries end up functioning like that. Benedict ends up establishing a monastery in Monte Cassino in 529. The idea of the monastery is you're training future missionaries. You're training people that are going to go out. They're going to go into these pagan territories. They're going to be in danger in some ways. And then Benedict trains them up and then he sends them throughout Europe. They establish monasteries in France and Germany and Britain. Remember, these are in the 600s. This is weird frontier territory. You know, when they go to these places, they are going to see a place that we today would not recognize. Bede says this in 731. He says, the Benedictine monks who came to England taught the Saxons not only the scriptures, but the ways of civilized life. So don't think of the monks as just bringing the gospel. They're also bringing knowledge of farming, medicine, reading. They're taking a lot of those benefits and blessings that they had because of the sophisticated culture of Rome that have still been passed on to them. And now they're taking them out into the rest of the world too. So notice the practical side to the evangelism that they're practicing, right? They are practicing mercy, but they're also just generally benefiting the people in the surrounding culture. They're giving Christianity a good name, if I can put it that way. Many pagans were not converted by Christians preaching. They were converted by one-on-one interaction with monks who lived out these Christian virtues. So like one of the rules of St. Benedict says, all guests who arrive should be received as Christ, for he will say, I was a stranger and you welcomed me. So what are they doing? They're early on saying it's important to show hospitality. It's important to show gentleness and kindness to people who are outsiders. So as you're going out into the world, monks, right? They're talking to monks. As you're going out into the world, you need to show hospitality too. You need to show mercy. You need to show kindness. Benedict leaves a legacy. There's a lot I could say about Benedict, but Benedict leaves a legacy. One of the things that he leaves is a legacy where Augustine of Canterbury, this is not Augustine, you know, that we think of, Augustine of Hippo, St. Augustine, this is Augustine of Canterbury. He's a Benedictine monk. So he's somebody who's trained under Benedict. And what does he do? He's sent by Gregory the Great to convert the Anglo-Saxons in England. And Pope Gregory Pope Gregory, in a letter to Augustine of Canterbury, says, Benedict's rule has prepared you well for this holy task of winning the English to Christ. So again, they have an evangelistic mindset. We need to get out into the rest of the world. We need to take the gospel to the rest of the world. St. Boniface, we're going to meet St. Boniface in a minute. He also is trained in the Benedictine order. So the Benedictine order ends up leaving a legacy of evangelists, people who are going to go out into the world. This last week was St. Patrick's Day. Was it Monday?
Yep.
All right. I'm not allowed to drink beer right now. I'm dieting. So I didn't have any Guinness. The day might as well not have existed for me. but we have a rise going on of Celtic Christianity. And it's a shame I can't give you the real story in its fullness, because if I do that, then we don't end up getting to some of the other things we need to talk about. But I do want to mention, you have Celtic Christianity ends up happening through somebody named Ninian. As far as we know, he's the first missionary. Ninian is in 360 is when he's born. He dies in 432. He's born in Roman Britain. He's trained in Rome. In 397, he goes back to Britain, and he goes back as a missionary. And the people groups there are the Picts and the Britons, the P-I-C-T-S. That's one group of people. And then you have these wild animals called the Britons. And he evangelizes the Picts, and Bede says this about him. So Bede, again, is the historian sort of writing after the fact. He says, the southern Picts abandoned their idolatry and accepted the faith through the preaching of Bishop Ninian. Remember, bishop's just another word for elder, but, you know, There are theological and ecclesiastical changes going on here that I'm not going to go into. But Ninian is one of the first missionaries to go to the Celtic people. He establishes the first known stone church in Scotland. You can look it up even today. It's called the Candida Casa. It's the White House is what it's called. And today all we have is the skeleton of the church, but you can look at it. This is a place that Ninian establishes in the 400s, very old. Because Ninian is so early, we actually don't have a ton of historical details about his life. Instead, like 600 or 700 years later, you have a guy writing his life story, like in the 12th century. So, but he says this about Ninian. He says Ninian preached in the Pict language. So in other words, he learned how to talk like the people he's talking to. He taught them scripture and doctrine. He baptized converts. He's moving them from the visibly moving them from paganism into Christianity. Don't underestimate the revolutionary nature of baptism. To receive baptism is a big deal. It's to put away that old life. It's to put away that paganism. And in that culture, that's a very stark change. It's a big deal to make the change and to make the decision. I'm going to be baptized. My children are going to be baptized. My family's going to be baptized. We're Christians now. We're not pagans anymore. And you see that visibly, that break that happens. Ninian is not just focused on one-time conversions, right? He's not going, I see that hand. All right. And then, you know, just kind of moves on from there. Instead, he's leaning on regular instruction and catechesis. This is according to the life of Ninian that ends up being written later. So he's evangelizing with the long view in mind. He's also doing something else. He is strategically converting tribal leaders. He is doing his best to influence the whole tribe. You know, it's a lot more bang for your buck if you can convince the leader to become a Christian and to lead his people toward Christianity than to go one by one and do the grassroots thing. And certainly that happens a lot. And that's a common theme of medieval evangelism. In fact, that's part of Patrick's mission in Ireland. You probably know the story of Patrick, how he was born in Roman Britain, captured by Irish raiders. He was enslaved in Ireland, worked as a shepherd. He was a slave in Ireland. He escapes, goes back to Britain, and then later God gives him a vision where he tells him to go back to Ireland, which is not something that he necessarily wanted to do. Patrick says this, if the document we have called the Confession of St. Patrick is correct and it's legit, this is what Patrick says. He says, I had a vision in my dreams of a man named Victoricus coming from Ireland with countless letters. And as I read, I heard the voice of the Irish. We beg you, holy boy, to come and walk among us once more. He hears their call. He hears the need. He realizes these are people. Yes, they kidnapped me, but they did it because they need Jesus. And so this vision compels him to go back to Ireland as a missionary. He goes back in 432. He's preaching to the Irish people. When he does this, he has to confront the society of the day. It can't just happen through persuasion. He has to confront. And so he's challenging the Druid leaders. He's challenging religious practices of the Druids. Part of what he has to do is show that the Christian God is powerful over the pagan deities. So I know it's 12:15. Give me a few more minutes extra. I'll kind of eke it out a little bit so I can give you sort of what happens here. One of the most famous stories, it's hard to tell with something as old as Patrick how much of this is true, how much of it's not. But the legend is that, if you've ever heard the legend of the Easter fire, how many of you heard the legend of the Easter fire from Patrick? Good. I'm giving you guys something you haven't heard. So the High King and the Druids would celebrate Beltane. Beltane was a major pagan festival marking the beginning of summer. Part of the ritual of Beltane was this. They had fires across Ireland that were extinguished, and there was a sacred fire that was lit at Tara. No other fires are allowed to burn until the king's ceremonial fire is lit. So Miurcia, in his book Life of Patrick, this was written in the 7th century, he says this. A decree went forth from the king that on the night of the festival, no fire should be kindled until the fire of Tara was lit. The lighting of the fire symbolized the power of the king and the authority of the Druids. So on the night of Easter, while the pagans were preparing for their Beltane fire, Patrick lit a great fire on the hill of Slain, 9 miles from Terah. And it said that the fire shone brightly and that it was seen from Terah, breaking the high king's decree. So basically, Patrick says, look what I can get away with doing. And you can imagine how risky and terrifying that must have been for him to violate the king's order. But the belief was this shouldn't have been possible. If the gods that the Druids believe in are real, how was it possible for Patrick to light this fire? And so the idea was, what does he do? He's directly clashing with the Druids. He's directly clashing with the religious beliefs of the people who are living there. You know, it called for a direct confrontation. And I think that there is a place here, and we can think about this too when it comes to, for example, Boniface. There are times where we need to think about the question, should we be confronting more directly than we are, right? Instead of just, I'm going to persuade, is there a need in some ways for direct confrontation that might take place, you know? This is just something that sort of takes wisdom to know the difference. But Patrick is also ministering with the long view in mind. He's training native Irish clergy. His plan is not to evangelize Ireland by just continuing to import Romans to keep coming up and just live on the continent. Instead, he knows that if this is going to work, the Irish themselves have to have their own priests. The Irish themselves have to have their own churches. The Irish themselves need to do this. And so that's what Patrick's work involves. There are other names here that I will mention, but I'm not going to go into depth. One is Columba. Columba is somebody who lives in 521 to 597. He's an Irish missionary monk who plays a crucial role in Christianizing Scotland. So he particularly ministers to the Picts people. He founds an abbey called Iona. It becomes a center of evangelism throughout Britain and Ireland. I'd love to tell you more about him. The conversion of King Brude. Columba ends up being part of the conversion of King Brude. What ends up happening is he has spiritual combat with the Pictish Druids. And what happens is there is he's demonstrating the power of Jesus over pagan magic. The legend is that he miraculously opened the locked gates of King Brude's fortress. And that should not have been possible. And he enters the fortress. You know, I almost think, you know, we're going to talk about the Enlightenment next week. And I wonder, are we so influenced by the Enlightenment that we hear about these legends of for example, Columba going into King Brude's fortress? Is there just a part of us that goes, oh, well, that didn't happen. I wonder what really happened, right? But I also think that as Christians, we believe that we live in a supernatural world. We believe that there are angels and demons, that there are supernatural forces. Part of me thinks that it would be healthy for us to hold open the very real possibility that God opened the doors of King Brude's fortress and allowed Columba to go in. I really think that we should open ourselves up to that possibility and stop being, Enlightenment people and become Christian people. And next week, what I'm going to do is sort of encourage you to think that way, because here's what I want to leave you with. We could talk about Columba on us. I could talk to you about the mission to the Slavs. I could talk to you about Cyril and Methodius. One of the things you see, though, that's common between all of the people that are written here that I could take you through, and it's actually kind of a shame that I'm moving so fast because I did a lot of work. but I also don't want to hold us up too much. What you'll start to see is this common theme that Christians realize they need to speak the language of the people they go to. That they need to understand the people that they go to. That there are times when there needs to be confrontation, and there are times when showing mercy and showing gentleness and persuasion is the way to go forward. And it just depends on where you're at. You see that employed in a lot of different ways. And so it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's not one-size-fits-all the way that these things happen. Maybe at some point Matthew and I can sort of do a little bit of maybe a podcast where we run through a lot of this. Important thing to end on, the conversion of Clovis. The conversion of Clovis happens. Clovis becomes the king of the Franks around 481. He is converted to Christianity. It's usually linked to a battle that happened in 496. What happened was he married a woman who was a Christian. She tries to convince him to become a Christian. He won't do it. So she persists and she prays for him. She speaks to him about the importance of Jesus. By the way, this is evangelism, right? She's evangelizing her husband. She's telling him, believe in the Lord Jesus. Here's what happens, though. He goes out to battle against the Alemanni. They're a German tribe in the east, to the east. And he cries out to God in a moment of desperation. And he promises that if he wins the battle, he'll become a Christian. This is something that ends up happening with Constantine as well. This ends up being sort of a common theme that sort of these pagans who are sort of resistant to Christianity, they've heard about Christ enough that they finally say, what if this would work? And they try it. And in their case, it works, right? He survives the battle. He wins. And he says, okay. And he's baptized the next year. And there are all these political implications. One thing is that because he's the king of the Franks, well, now the Franks and the Romans are sort of on chummy terms now. And there are a lot of things that come about because of this. But what you actually start to see is that now the center of Europe itself is now Christian and not simply pagan. That means there's a lot of work that happens to remove the paganism. You have St. Boniface, who's known as the apostle to the Germans. One of his jobs is to go and have a face-off with unbelievers, to have face-offs with the pagans. If you've heard the story of the felling of the Thor oak, according to tradition, Boniface felt that it was absolutely necessary that he cut down this oak that is sort of dedicated to Thor. It's meant to be Thor's oak. When he cuts it down, what is he showing? Thor is nothing. Thor is nobody. Thor doesn't strike Boniface dead. Instead, Boniface strikes Thor down. And so he takes the tree and he uses the wood to build a chapel for the worship of the Christian God, which is a tremendous visible way of putting into practice the defeat of the pagan gods by Christianity. Again, we need to think about when it's necessary for face-offs and when it's wise for us to instead maybe take another path. But here it's important. Clovis ends up making way for Charlemagne. Could talk a lot about Charlemagne, but one of the things you see with Charlemagne is his religious practices end up making Christianity a serious central part of the culture, of the society, of the world in which they live. That does not mean that life under Charlemagne is like paradise. It doesn't mean that it's great to be a pagan living under Charlemagne. Trust me, you don't want to be a pagan living under Charlemagne. But the reason I'm saying all of this, and this is how we're going to bring it back together, and I know I'm taking us longer than I thought, but this will get us ready for the Enlightenment next week. It is important that we feel the difference between what was practiced 1,200 years ago and the environment that we live in today. We need to feel that difference, because here's the deal. Today, we can scarcely imagine forcing someone to be baptized. Which Charlemagne absolutely did. Charlemagne absolutely forced baptisms, and if you wouldn't be baptized, you were killed. If the numbers are right, like 4,500 people refused to convert and be baptized, and Charlemagne struck them down. That is a world that feels incredibly foreign to us. We might even judge somebody like Charlemagne, thinking, what's that?
How many were baptized?
I don't know, but it was a lot more than 4,000. It was a very, very large number. There's probably a way to find out, but sometimes those numbers are in doubt, so who knows. But second, I think that just thinking about these things, and I didn't do a good job spelling them out because I skipped so much stuff, but it gives us a feel for the vast difference between how evangelism happened in the first century and how it took place by the early Middle Ages, right? Suddenly you see it becomes much more institutionalized. It becomes much more professionalized. If you're going to go and evangelize, you've got to be a professional. But then you see that not everybody is, right? The Clovis ends up becoming a Christian because his wife, a layperson, persuaded him and hammered him and prayed for him and probably irritated him a lot. But eventually he came around, right? So there are still examples of individuals who are really persuading their loved ones, come to Jesus. Third, this shows us that the world of the Middle Ages leading up through the Reformation in the 1500s was one that was deeply religious and very uniform, and that religiosity is imposed from the top down. And so just know that's about to flip. After the Reformation, that turns upside down. Fourth, by the Middle Ages, theological belief is very solidified in all strata of society, especially in Europe, but also throughout much of the world that had not been conquered by Islam up to this point. So once we get to the Enlightenment, that's next week, what you should see is that things change very drastically. The Christendom of Charlemagne's past becomes splintered, and the Enlightenment creates a totally different theological and religious environment. But if you're going to feel that change, what we have to do is we have to study and think about it, and that's worth our effort. We're going to talk about the Enlightenment because that's actually the world we live in. We don't live in this world. We do not. What we have been looking at over the last 45 minutes, maybe longer because I'm naughty, what we've actually been looking at is very foreign territory to us. This is a strange land that we're in at the moment. You will feel more at home in the Enlightenment when we get there, which is, I'm not excited to tell you that, but that is the truth. And so next week we'll look at the Enlightenment, and this is where the Enlightenment's going to matter and why I'm emphasizing this, because it's still the air we breathe. It is still the environment that makes evangelism hard for us even today. So we understand the Enlightenment. I think we get closer to understanding what it is that our friends and neighbors and family members think like that actually puts a lot of obstacles in our way and makes it more challenging. So thank you for staying the extra 15 minutes. I'm super sorry to all the kids. I'm going to pray very briefly and send you off, and then we'll talk about the Enlightenment in 2 weeks, not next week. I keep saying next week. Heavenly Father, thank you for showing us that your word spreads in ways that are wild and different from what we might be used to. I pray that you, though, would help us to discern the days and the times in which we live. Would you give us wisdom? We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.